Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Prithvi Mruthyunjaya of Stanford University. We discuss the intersection of ocular oncology and vitreoretinal surgery in his practice, amongst other topics. Today's shameless plug, we'll be conducting a first ever online content for ophthalmologist marketing and education course at the AAO annual meeting in Chicago. The course is Monday, October 29th at 4:30 p.m., room N136. The panel will include Drs. Usiwoma Abugo, Rahul Khurana, Steve Christensen, Matthew Weed, and myself. We will cover it all in an hour, so you won't want to miss it. It should be fun and educational. We really appreciate the support if you come out to see us. If any questions, you can always reach out to me directly. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by Dr. Prithvi Mruthyunjaya. Dr. Mruthyunjaya is Associate Professor of Ophthalmology at Stanford University, where he is the Director of Ocular Oncology at the Byers Eye Institute. Prithvi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jay. It's a real honor. Thank you.
You're a new guest. First question all new guests get, which is interesting for everyone, but especially for trainees, is why did you decide to become an ophthalmologist, and then why retina and ocular oncology?
I am a new guest, that's true, but a fan of the podcast. I think you guys are doing a great job. So I was a son of two immigrants. My parents were dentists. I guess I should have been a dentist, but I chose otherwise. But I think for me, my whole influences in ophthalmology have been having great interactions with mentors. And I was really fortunate growing up in Rochester, New York, to have Dr. G.N. Rao, who's the founder and director of the L.V. Prasad Eye Institute, as my neighbor down the street. So I grew up with his kids, and he was on faculty of the University of Rochester as a cornea specialist, and at the prime of his career, decided that he was going to go back to India and found this amazing institution for patient care and for research, and basically, you know, packed up and left with this great plan in mind. And I always had this great reverence for him as a teacher, as just with his reputation. I didn't know any better when I was in high school, but he has always been, you know, a true guiding, you know, vision and force in my life. And so I think I always knew I wanted to go into medicine. I always knew I wanted to be an ophthalmologist, and primarily because of my interactions with Dr. Rao. And I had the opportunity back in the day to work in labs at the University of Rochester, where they're doing some initial work on retinal transplantation. And I got to work with some monkey models when I was even in high school and in college. So for me, it was always ophthalmology. It was kind of the default all through my rotations in medical school, and I don't think anything came close. So that's why I became an eye doctor.
And then you went on to do your residency training, and why retina, and then why ocular oncology, which is a even more subspecialized field?
Yeah, so you know, I was fortunate to begin my residency training at Duke, and that was really kind of in the real heyday, the late 90s, that I felt of some great innovation and great characters that were all part of retina at that time. So Duke had a tradition at that time where a lot of people kind of went into retina. So a lot of folks now that, you know, are my colleagues were people that I really looked up to, you know, through training. So there was this strong like push for people to want to go into retina. Robert Mockimer still walked the halls. You know, my residency mentors, you know, ended up being my fellowship mentors throughout at Duke. So Glenn Jaffe, Cindy Toth, Sharon Fekrat, Eric Postel, you know, still kind of make the core of the senior faculty at Duke. So I had the opportunity, to do a lot of work with Brooks McKeown when I was a resident, and I stayed on to be a chief resident at the Duke Eye Center for 2 years, which is a little crazy, but I had the opportunity to work with Glenn Jaffe on sustained drug delivery work during that time, and then a chance to stay on for fellowship, which worked out really well, both professionally and also kind of coordinating careers with my wife, who's an oncologist in training at the time. So as I was going through fellowship, I knew that academics was my destiny, where I'd be ending through. And ocular oncology kind of came about to me as a real great opportunity. So Duke was looking to expand their service, and their need was for someone to bring ocular oncology in a more formal way back to Duke. They had some folks doing that work in the past, but they were really kind of lacking that in the department at the time. So in discussions with leadership, there was an opportunity for me to do additional training and then bring that back to join the faculty, which I always thought was a great idea because, I really couldn't peel a membrane better than Brooks McKeown or, fix a detachment better than Cindy Toth or, put a retisert in better than Glenn Jaffe. So I felt like I needed something more to add to the conversation, and this was that opportunity. So we looked around for fellowship in the U.S., and there really weren't many that were taking on trainees at the time that were going to be, staying in departments in the U.S. So we looked abroad, and I had the opportunity to go to the Moorfields Eye Institute in London and study under one of the kind of the grandfatherly figures in the field, John Hungerford. So that was a great experience. I mean, I was seeing a new healthcare system. I was it was a very hands-on fellowship that was oncology only, so a lot of anterior segment and posterior segment oncology work. It was really neat to kind of see just the types of patients and just the healthcare system in general there, and that was an incredible opportunity. And unfortunately, I had to be separated from my my young child and my wife at the time, but still made some great friends who are now leaders in their own right in the UK. So then I came back to Duke and had that opportunity to start the service as part of the retina division. So I saw in the beginning a lot of patients that were just the junior faculty special for retina cases, but then we built a program over the years that became a good regional referral center for both anterior and posterior segment oncology. But what I would always say is it had a very retina flavor to it in terms of how we managed our patients.
And speaking of retina flavor, ocular oncology is an interesting and diverse field because while many people are trained in retina, there are some people who are anterior segment ocular oncologists, there are oculoplastic surgeons who are ocular oncologists, and you have the perspective where you did both those training fellowships and practiced using both your retina skills and your oncology skills. So my question for you is, for example, vitrectomy, there are certain scenarios where vitrectomy is employed from an ocular oncology standpoint. What are the most common situations when you'll intervene as a vitreoretinal surgeon in ocular oncology standpoint? What are the most common referrals you got at Duke and at Stanford that would end up being things that would be surgical, not just, for example, plaque placement, but where you actually have to enter the eye?
Correct. So I think that I've always been fascinated by just our ability as retina surgeons to see the field in terms of access into the eye and to be able to control the eye. So the types of scenarios that I've been using vitrectomy instrumentation or vitrectomy techniques, first and foremost, are in how I perform my choroidal tumor biopsies. So I've been very interested in kind of different ways that we can control the eye and still get our samples as we need to. So, the situations that are most obvious is that when we are doing treatment for these choroidal melanomas, we are obtaining tissue specimens for prognosis using various genetic testing, but also for diagnosis. So if it's a condition that we're not sure exactly what it is, and we want to get a good specimen, I've always found the control of going into the eye using a biome and a light and having the control of the cannulas that are valved allows me to get into the eye, get my specimen either with a, say, a 27-gauge cutter or even with a needle on aspiration, and then to control any complications such as bleeding, but also to get that specimen out in a way that isn't going to contaminate the tissues on the outside of the eye, all with excellent visualization. And I think that's what's been great for my fellows and people that I've been working with, is that when I'm doing these procedures, they can clearly see what I'm seeing. And I think that's helped from a training aspect too, kind of using these instrumentations. Also on the tumor side, we're often dealing with biopsying the retina or the choroid for conditions like vitreoretinal lymphoma. And also dealing with complications of the treatments that we induce, so secondary hemorrhages after radiation treatment or exudative detachment control. In general, we're trying not to go back into these eyes if we need to, but I think with the safety and the approaches that have kind of evolved over time with the instrumentation, I think that it's not a taboo anymore to go in to eyes that have had treated tumors in adults specifically. And I think that, we can reestablish a lot of anatomic planes, even though vision tends to lag in some of these patients.
So let's talk about the scenario. So let's say, for example, choroidal melanoma, which is the most common primary tumor in adults, and you have a treated choroidal tumor, for example, or choroidal melanoma. So let's talk about surgery. Most common indications for going in. What is the minimum time between when you are treat them and when you would go in? And then let's talk about surgery itself. Are there any particular cautions or pearls you would pass on to fellows or doctors who may be operating on these patients who are not specifically ocular oncology trained?
All great questions. So the most common scenario that we would go in a treated melanoma is most likely any secondary neovascular complications. So if the patient has a new vitreous hemorrhage or persistent exudative retinal detachment that we presume is due to, for example, just widespread ischemia, sometimes patients can develop epiretinal membranes and have traction that can cause peripheral traction detachments as well. So usually it's complications after the treatment. So the first consideration is what is the true visual potential of the eye and what's our goal? If it's to reestablish the eye so that it does not become a neovascular painful eye that then has to be removed, then I think that's very reasonable to enter and approach the eye surgically. So it's the minority of our patients, but I think more and more it's becoming a bigger part of the practice. In terms of the surgical planning in these scenarios, I do like the fact that we have, excellent wide field viewing. I like the fact that we have valved cannulas so that we're not allowing kind of egress of excessive fluid or material that could still be potentially viable cells if you're not sure about the eye that you're going into, and you don't want to seed the areas of the sclera or the subconjunctival space. So to be able to go in and out through these portals, I think, has been very helpful. I try to minimally disrupt the tumor if I can at all help it, unless I'm specifically going in to, say, remove an ischemic source of a necrotic tumor itself. But we're still carrying out first principles. So, we still want the highlight off. We still want to, treat any atrophic areas. We tend to do a lot of panretinal laser photocoagulation to reduce ischemia as we need to. And then we're trying to get out of the eye. I always suture the sclerotomies, and I always treat those sclerotomies with double freeze-thaw cryo. And I think that's kind of a holdback to the initial times that we were doing these choroidal biopsies for diagnosis of these untreated melanomas, because there was this concern that as you're coming out of the eye, you could be trapping cells either within the sclera or the pars plana region or under the conjunctiva itself. So I'm a bit of a fuddy-duddy in that way, even though the wounds all will close on their own. I just like that extra sense of security that we're, you know, kind of keeping these eyes as intact and as whole as we can throughout the surgery and in the post-operative period. So those are kind of my the two things that add a few minutes to my cases, is the suturing of the sclerotomies and cryo to the sclerotomy sites.
You know, we've been talking a lot about the solid tumors. You referenced earlier getting a specimen, for example, for lymphoma, like primary intraocular lymphoma. And lymphoma is something that commonly will get misdiagnosed or missed, and then eventually will end up in an ocular oncologist's office. Let's talk about surgery in those cases. So when you are going in to get a specimen, you mentioned you may do it with the cutter, you may do it with a needle. Again, any pearls, anything that you do special with the sample, and in terms of how do you collect the sample, in terms of making sure you get a good undiluted sample?
I think that intraocular lymphoma is a challenge to all of us in retina, and it doesn't often end up in the office of a vitreoretinal specialist unless an ocular oncologist, unless they may also have retina focus or training. So I think with any of these scenarios where there are cells in the vitreous and inflammation that's not responding, you just have to have, first off, a differential that includes lymphoma when it's appropriate. So kind of thinking along that line, making sure kind of preoperatively you've done the workup that you need to rule in or rule out other conditions, then you go in to make the decision for a diagnostic vitrectomy.
And forgive me for interrupting, sure. But just for the trainees listening, what sort of things would clue you in or make you suspect lymphoma?
So lymphoma is, when you're thinking of an older patient that has typically unilateral vitritis, that may really not have any other signs in the retina, such as a viral retinitis with hemorrhaging or whitening. And then that overlap of patients that have vitreoretinal lymphoma that can develop areas of whitening within the retina, that can have kind of sectoral areas of nodular sub-RPE or subretinal deposits. We use multimodal imaging to look for these alterations on OCT, but also fluorescein angiography to look for areas of leakage as well. So sometimes very nonspecific, Jay, in terms of what we would find as one or two clear clinical signs. And then in the context of whether they have a history of lymphoma in general, CNS disease is going to be akin to having ocular involvement. But it's important to have a tissue diagnosis because our medical oncologists and neuro-oncology colleagues often need to know that as part of their staging in order to make that determination. But there's all of these uveitic masquerades that can overlap as well. So thinking about conditions like sarcoidosis or syphilis or tuberculosis, in the broad differentials, but also a viral retinitis can also have some overlap features in the same patient. So I think it's putting all that together into the clinical context of it's just not fitting a typical case of an intermediate or posterior uveitic condition. Once we make that decision and we go into surgery, I think there's a lot of planning that should take place even before you start to embark on doing these diagnostic vitrectomies. And that happens not just the night before, but probably weeks and months before, especially for the trainees that are starting their new practices. I would insist that everyone know their pathologist, where the specimen is going to know their cytopathologist and whether they're comfortable or experienced in diagnosing intraocular lymphoma, because we give them very few cells and they have to make an important call based on that. And also to know what the protocols are in your hospital or health system for testing such as flow cytometry, and also if your system prefers the cells be placed in some form of buffer or other preservative to make sure that the cells don't die on the way there. One of the challenges in some of the places that I operate now is that the lab is not physically attached to the operating room area. So in my previous practice, I would collect my specimen and physically walk it to the lab myself and make sure that it got into the hands of the technicians at those labs. Now in some of my sites, I have to rely on a courier to go. So whereas before I wouldn't place these cells into any kind of preservative solution, now I put it into preservative to keep them together. So the worst thing you can do is take one of these biopsy procedures and you don't get a response because either the cells were dead or they just, you know, lost their morphology. And it's such precious tissue, the vitreous, that you know, once you've removed the bulk of it, it becomes harder to get a yield to go back in again. So I think that planning is really important, Jay. So when we do the diagnostic vitrectomies, we use a typical three-port pars planus setup. I prefer 25 gauge. There's some data to suggest that maybe the smaller gauge cutters might cause some trauma to the cells, but I don't think that's practically a real-life concern. But I like the flow that comes in for the 25 gauge cutter to do these procedures. I still tend to do them under fluid, though I have done them under air infusion, which does give an advantage of getting more vitreous out. We set up the three ports and we attach the infusion line to the infusion port, but we don't run the infusion into the eye. So our first collection is with a syringe attached to the distal tubing of the cutter, and then we engage the cut while the assistant is aspirating. So we collect between 2 and 2.5 cc's of undiluted vitreous. And then we'll switch out the syringe and then turn the infusion on and obtain about 10 cc's of partially diluted vitreous. But the key is not to just sit in one spot when you're in the eye. Usually it's my fellow who's navigating the cutter and I'm the one who's aspirating. And just like when we're learning phaco surgery, you don't want a phaco BSS. When you're doing a diagnostic vitrectomy, you don't want to be cutting and sucking infusion fluid. So you really have to be aggressive to move the cutter around and find the vitreous. You can often see these large cells in your view, and you really have to go after and chase them because even one cell that that they can capture and find might be the one that makes the difference in your diagnosis. So to be very aggressive with that. And at that point, you know, you can end the case there after looking around and making sure the retina looks good, or if there's other pathology that needs to be addressed, then you can move to a therapeutic vitrectomy to fix that. The next issue is just the specimens themselves and how we divide them. Making sure that you send them to all the places that they need to go to in a prompt manner. So that's typically cytopathology, to the flow cytometry lab. If you wanted to do any viral studies, then to send those out for PCR. And it's both a mix of the diluted and the undiluted vitreous that need to go. So there's a wee bit of chaos in the OR, I find, because the nurses are often a little overwhelmed with all the places these specimens need to go to. But again, preparing your team for what needs to happen and making sure everyone knows where, even writing it on a whiteboard, where all these specimens are going to, and taking the time to label even the bags that they're going to be placed into after they're separated can help your staff out quite a bit, and to ensure that these specimens aren't lost or sent to the wrong place and then have to find their way back. That was one of the things Glenn Jaffe taught me a long time ago. I was very meticulous about that, and I guess good habits sometimes can follow you after fellowship.
Right. And you referenced a couple of things we're going to talk about, kind of switching gears. You know, you referenced the idea of the two-man game, whether it's you or the fellow, or you know, who's driving and who's pulling. You staff fellows. You staffed fellows at Duke. You staffed fellows at Stanford. That's an integral part of your practice. Again, from a vitreoretinal standpoint, but also ocular oncology standpoint, what are kind of the biggest things you've learned in terms of staffing fellows from the staffer's perspective, in terms of approaching a fellow's development from day one till the day they graduate?
Well, it's that's a long and loaded question. I think some of the most rewarding aspects of what we do is the chance to be able to work with just some of the brightest minds in medicine. And you know, I've been really fortunate to have outstanding fellows that I've been able to work with. I'll say that the most important thing is just how well you can communicate what you're thinking and your thoughts and your experiences back to them. I think what we do is so much about the nuances and the tricks and the experience that just can't be fully read in a book. And I think I've been imprinted on by having had really great teachers who emphasized the importance of the fellow and to give the fellow every opportunity to experience all elements of our field with supervision. And I think that's always been my goal going forward, is to never let my fellow feel like they're on their own or kind of flailing, that I've given them enough tools for independence, but also, you know, with me, they're always as backup. So I'm happy, you know, if I never have to switch seats, you know, with the fellow being able to manage everything. But it's important to know that, you know, being able to switch and to watch and learn is a part of that process. I think that fellows sometimes get very excited about, you know, how many cases they're doing and their numbers and their case logs and such. And I'm not a numbers guy. I think for me, it's just the quality of the experience that you can have as a fellow. And I think that's what I realize is, you know, my responsibility to the fellow, is to give them that quality experience. So I think a lot of it is, it's always hearing my mentors, you know, yelling at me or talking to me when I was a fellow, and all those tips that stay in my head. It's like my imperative to pass those along to my trainees as well. So that's like my guiding principles. Like, you know, I was trained by some excellent teachers, and you know, those tips are still with me. How can I make those relevant to the technologies that we're using today and to each individual case? So I think that's been you know, a lot of fun. You know, you bring up the fact that I do take care of patients that aren't your typical, you know, straightforward vitreoretinal surgical cases or clinical cases. And I think that I found that's added maybe a dimension to their practice. You know, very few of my fellows have continued to do anything in ocular oncology, but I feel like they can approach a patient that has an atypical lesion or needs a diagnostic vitrectomy. And I think that they can do a good job taking care of their patient in their particular setting. Like, I don't want them to be like, oh, instant referral and not be able to, you know, tackle it based on, you know, whatever situation that they're in. But I think, you know, looking at, say, if someone was doing uveitis or ocular oncology, there are clinical situations that, you know, do push the boundaries of what a typical vitreoretinal surgeon would be involved in. And I think that I would like to think that it enhances their practice and their abilities over time. I will also say, I think my fellows sometimes, you know, roll their eyes, because I do take care of some anterior segment tumor work as well. So, you know, they probably used more amniotic membrane than they really care to admit to during their retina fellowship. So I'm working on that too.
Well, and the final thing I'm going to ask you to talk about, we've had other people talk about this, is not a new topic, but and again, I think it seems like a new topic when you're leaving training. Everyone thinks they're leaving fellowship. They've gotten that one job. They're going to stay at that job forever, and it's going to be a perfect job, and they're never going to leave. And there's a lot of obstacles to changing job, you know, family considerations outside of work, but even at work, nuts and bolts things like licensure and building a practice and practicing in a different state with different regulations, perhaps. But then, if for your example, working at a different academic institution and the different sort of setup, different EMRs, different philosophies maybe and cultures. So talk a little bit about your experience just changing coasts and changing two very prestigious and prominent institutions with a long history, kind of the factors that motivated you to do that and kind of the challenges but also the rewards that you've experienced moving.
So it's been about 2 years now that we've moved from North Carolina here to Northern California, I would tell people that I honestly thought they would have buried me next to my slit lamp at Duke. That was kind of like my long-term plan to be at Duke forever, and it was a great group of colleagues that I had. Many of them were my teachers that now became, you know, not only my partners but my really close friends. And it's you know, a fantastic environment. And I think that, you know, opportunities come and they, you know, can kind of cloak themselves in different ways. So in my situation, the opportunity kind of arose from opportunities that my wife, who's, you know, my best friend, had for her career as well. So she was looking to make a change from academics as well, and has moved into drug development. And as she was looking for opportunities, I think we rely in Retina on just the close-knit nature of our brother and sisterhood with our fellow retina specialists. So as you know, we're looking to land in the Bay Area, we reached out to our friends who I've known from fellowship, from the fellowship trail, from, you know, working on different projects with, and everyone was just really great. They were straight shooters. They kind of told me the lay of the land in different parts of the country, whether, you know, there were openings, there weren't openings, private practice, you know, mixed practices, academics. And then as we were looking, it became very evident that the group here at Stanford had, you know, they were undergoing this this great metamorphosis in the growth of the department. I had, you know, good friends in the faculty that were here. Darius Moshfeghi and I were buddies for years and just never had a chance to work together. So I think that as in my case, it couldn't have been a better landing spot, because I was moving from an academic department to another academic department, from a larger one to one that was trying to become a large department. I think that it really afforded me an opportunity to kind of step away a little bit from the shadow of my teachers and mentors, and kind of create my own direction and my own service here in the oncology world, and, you know, take all those lessons that I had starting as a junior faculty member and growing over the years, and see if I could build something that looked a little different, that maybe offered the same, you know, types of treatments that were a little different than what was the routine here in Northern California, but do it in maybe a little faster timeline than what I had done before, and with the support of with a different group of people here that all, you know, were looking to my success. So I felt very fortunate, Jay. Like, I think I don't think I could have asked for that better ability to land in a situation that you know, didn't look that different from one which I left, but still allowed me to kind of re-flavor it to the situation. But I think moving is always a challenge, and at different times and at different age, you have to consider a lot of things. You have to consider your family foremost. You know, if you have children, or if you don't, or if you're going to have, you're thinking about having children, how does that factor into where you want to end up? You know, is everyone going to be happy, and at what point will they all be happy? I think that's important. You know, I had in my situation, it was a two professional career move, and I think for us, we spent a lot of time, you know, kind of ensuring that each other was going to be okay, and I think that was helpful for both of us. And I think some of the things to keep in mind is that, and I always tell my fellows, it's always a two-year rule in my mind. Like whenever you start a practice or get a job, especially out of fellowship, you know, don't be impatient. You can't expect everything to be perfect on day one, and that's why it's my two-year rule. It takes on average about 2 years for people to figure their practice out, whether it's referral practices, the name of the OR circulator that comes in once a week, you know, who's where you're going to go to find your patients. And it takes time. And if you're lucky, it happens before 2 years. But, you know, if it takes three and the situation is good, you know, that still, you know, falls within the bell curve. So I think that I've been it's taught me some, you know, patience, and it's taught me, you know, just trying to make the best of situations. But I think the most important thing with any move is just, you know, the handshake of the people that you're going to be working with, and whether you feel supported. And, you know, there's always the nitty gritty of contracts and all that, but I think for me it's about the people. And you know, I felt that that was a good situation for me. But it's taught me to take my own lessons and remember all the stuff that I would, you know, maybe bore my fellows with about life lessons, but kind of apply them on my own. There's easy days and there's harder days when you're first starting, because you're used to kind of going at 120% plus, like we all do. And when you start a new practice, that's, you know, there are some more quiet days than not. But I think it just forces you to kind of get all the other elements of your world, research and clinical care and education side, all kind of tucked in together, because invariably things get busy.
Perfect. Well, Dr. Mrunjaya, that's great words of wisdom for our fellows, but also the young faculty like myself and my colleagues. So we really appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time and for calling us from the West Coast and doing this. And hopefully people appreciate it. So you're going to Academy, I'm sure?
Yes, we'll be at Academy and looking forward to meeting everyone there.
All right, perfect. Well,
and maybe coming to your course. I heard it's going to be a good one.
Oh, shameless plug number 554, whatever number that is. I'll take it. Well, hopefully I'll see you there. Thanks so much, and see you in Chicago.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Jay. Have a good one.
You too.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 133 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You'll find our blog, Equal Round and Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. On the website, you can sign up for our mailing list for the most recent episodes. You can also subscribe in the iTunes Store and Google Play. We are on Twitter at RetinaPodcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website, or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Feedback is the lifeblood of what we do, so we appreciate feedback on future episode ideas, things we are doing well, and things we can continue to do better as we go forward in the future. And we appreciate all the positive reviews people have left in the iTunes Store. Many thanks to Dr. Mrunjaya for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Benacasa, and Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Schreather, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.